Hello and welcome to the Arizona Capital Times on Sun Sounds. My name is John Coe. I am in Flagstaff and I will be your volunteer reader for today, reading articles that were published in the Arizona Capital Times on or about April 19th, 2024. Abortion law to dominate action at legislature again this week. Written by Howard Fisher and published in the Arizona Capital Times on April 21st, 2024. State lawmakers return Wednesday with another attempt to deal with the 1864 abortion law. But it won't go away this week, no matter what happens in the House or Senate. The Senate appears poised to approve repeal, but not just yet. The Arizona Constitution requires all measures to be read, quote, on three different days, and with the legislature, now on a once-a-week schedule, Senator Ana Hernandez, a Democrat from Phoenix, says that makes May 1st the earliest her chamber could give final approval. More problematic is what happens in the House, where Speaker Ben Thoma could take any Senate-passed bill and put it into a committee to never be heard from again. That's precisely what they did earlier this year when Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton introduced identical legislation. But there are indications that the Tucson Democrat may finally have the votes this Wednesday to bypass the Speaker and bring the measure directly to the floor for a debate. And if she then wins a second vote, one repealing the territorial era law that bans abortion except to save the life of a mother, that could pave the way for the Senate to simply ratify the change. Even if that were to occur, and repeal backers are still counting the votes, procedural requirements would make May 1st the earliest unless lawmakers scrap their Wednesday-only schedule. But it still may not be fast enough to ensure there will be no break in abortion access. Time is of the essence. On Friday, Attorney General Chris Mays sent a letter to hospitals and medical providers informing them that, despite the Arizona Supreme Court ruling 2 weeks ago upholding the 1864 law, they are in no immediate legal jeopardy if they continue to perform procedures. Mays pointed out that the justices stayed their ruling for 14 days. That is this Wednesday. But she noted that there is also a court order in a separate challenge to the territorial law in which her predecessor, Mark Brnovich, agreed not to enforce the old law for 45 days after the effective date of any Supreme Court ruling upholding the law. That, she said, makes June 8th the earliest that any criminal charges could be brought. The only thing is, if Hernandez and Stahl Hamilton can get a final vote by May 1st and an immediate signature by Governor Katie Hobbs, the change would not be in effect until 91 days after the legislature finally adjourns. And given the pace of the current session, the effective date for adjournment could be August or later. In the interim, that would leave only the executive order by Hobbs stripping county attorneys of their right to prosecute abortion cases as the only shield for medical providers. And while the governor said she is confident in her authority to have the order issued, she also said it will be up to doctors and others to decide if they're willing to risk violating a law, one no longer protected by court order, that could put them in prison for up to 5 years. That still leaves the more immediate question of whether there are the votes to repeal the old law regardless of the effective date. The problem is not the Senate, where Republicans T.J. Schaap of Coolidge and Shauna Bollock of Phoenix have already voted to align with all Democrats to set the repeal proposed by Hernandez in motion. In the House, Republican Matt Gress of Phoenix voted with the Democrats last week on Stahl Hamilton's bid to bring her already introduced repeal measure to the floor, but that just created a 30-30 tie. All eyes now are on Representative Tim Dunn. The Yuma Republican said he supports repeal, but unlike Gress, he has so far been unwilling to support the necessary preliminary motion, override the objections of the House Speaker to bring the repeal to the floor. Dunn did not immediately return calls about his plans for this week. There is also a political component to all of this. Gress is in a competitive district, where voters have shown that they are willing to elect Democrats as much as they are Republicans. His seatmate in the House is Democrat Laura Tarrick, and voters in his LD4 ousted Republican Nancy Bartow in favor of Democrat Christine Marsh. Several other House Republicans are in a similarly politically competitive situation. Dunn is in a safer, largely Republican district, but he is attempting this year to convince voters to let him move to the Senate in a race where he will face off against Sonia Willis. Another wild card has been Representative David Cook. But the Globe Republican faces the opposite situation as some of his GOP colleagues. He is running for Senate to oust incumbent Republican Wendy Rogers of Flagstaff in the safely Republican district, and Cook must worry that the far more conservative Rogers will use any vote by him to loosen abortion restrictions against him. The bottom line? Cook said he won't be voting to override TOMA, even just to put the repeal issue up for a vote. Ditto Representative Justin Wilmeth. Quote, I will not roll the speaker, he said. But unlike Cook, the Phoenix Republican said he will vote to repeal the 1864 law if the Democrats find two other Republicans to get the issue to a roll call vote. Quote, my district is probably very much in favor of repealing it, he said. A lot of what happens depends on TOMA. The speaker has made it clear he believes life begins at conception, and that abortion at any stage is the killing of a child. Personal views aside, he is under his own political pressure in a crowded race for Congress in CD8, where other primary foes like Trent Franks and Anthony Kern are ardent supporters of the 1864 law. But TOMA also has effectively acknowledged that many Arizonans do not support the old law, and that they are likely to get a chance in November to enshrine a constitutional right to abortion within the state constitution. It would allow abortion through fetal viability, with exceptions beyond that for maternal, physical, and mental health. So he has been urging House Republicans to hold the line, at least for now, and keep the 1864 law in place, while staff considers alternatives that could also be placed on the November ballot to undermine the initiative. Those alternatives so far include a ban at 6 weeks and another at 14 weeks. Organizers of the initiative have blasted a blatant method to confuse voters and siphon votes away from the broader law. There's also another bit of calculus. Polls suggest voters would overwhelmingly support the initiative, even with its allowance for post-viability abortions in cases of maternal, mental, and physical health, if the only other option is the territorial ERA law and its virtual ban on the procedure. But that could change if they are being asked to choose between the initiative and a 15-week ban. What would remain of the old law were repealed? Of the 11,407 abortions performed in Arizona in 2022, the most recent figures available, just 380 were performed after the 15th week of pregnancy. Discounting procedures where the fetal age was not known, that is just 3.3% of the total. Hernandez, however, said she still believes the initiative would be necessary, and the key is that without the initiative, there are no protections in the Arizona Constitution for the right of women to terminate a pregnancy. Quote, if we don't have that in the state constitution, then we have no rights, Hernandez said. Quote, what will happen if we cannot get the initiative passed? We will continue to see different attacks, even more restrictions, she said. I wouldn't be surprised if they try to reduce it down to a 6-week ban like there exists in Florida. You're listening to the Arizona Capital Times on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been providing information access since 1979, and you can always listen to our live stream at sunsounds.org. Hobbs orders hiring freeze, wants agencies to propose spending cuts. Written by Bob Christie and published in the Arizona Capital Times on April 21st, 2024. Governor Katie Hobbs has ordered what is essentially a hiring freeze for new state employees and instructed her department heads to send her a plan this week to cut $1.2 billion in spending out of their current and coming year budgets. The move is a major admission that the state's budget shortfall is going to require big belt tightening and fast. The details were outlined in a Friday letter to state agency heads from Hobbs Operations Director, obtained by Capital Media Services. The letter sets out a headcount cap that will allow agencies to replace employee losses, but not to fill currently vacant posts, at least in most cases. It also limits moving spending to contracted workers to avoid shifting expenses off the regular state books. Pay raises are also off limits. The letter directs agency heads to present plans to trim 4% from their current year spending and plan for ongoing 2% cuts in the budget year that starts July 1st. The letter specifies that Hobbs is looking to add to cuts already outlined in her state budget proposal, which was released in January. With just months remaining in the current budget year and a constitutional ban on deficit spending, the cuts must come fast. Negotiations between Hobbs, staffers, and leaders in the Republican-controlled legislature on a state budget package started in the past week. The initial meetings came after an April 11th update on state finances from the legislature's budget analysts showed that a slightly better forecast than was expected in January. The new forecast shows the state faces a $1.8 billion shortfall in the current and coming fiscal years, a $400 million improvement, but still a major hole in the governor's proposed $16.2 billion state spending plan. Hobbs' January budget plan included a 1% agency spending cut and slashed more than $1 billion from an already budgeted spending for roads, IT, and other projects to make up some of the shortfall. Her plan also anticipated a $244 million cut to the state's universal school voucher plan, a non-starter for Republicans, but one that Hobbs spokesman Christian Slater declined to acknowledge on Saturday. That clearly isn't enough. Republican Senate President Warren Peterson declined to comment on the governor's new moves or budget negotiations on Saturday, but he did say that GOP lawmakers have presented Hobbs with a plan to cut $2 billion in spending. Slater said the move is to seek additional cuts from state agency heads as a needed step, but he called it an exercise that is not set in stone. Quote, "This isn't, for example, a done deal," Slater said. Quote, "It is not giving up that voucher cut proposal from her executive budget, but is asking agencies to find us some efficiencies, find those places in state government where it isn't running efficiently," he said. "And that is important information for when we're discussing the budget and when we're trying to plan out a couple of years ahead as well." Hiring freezes, whether set in stone or headcount caps, as Hobbs Operations Director Ben Henderson calls them in his letter, are not unheard of in state government. Former governors Doug Ducey and Jane Hall, both Republicans, used them to crimp state spending. So did Democrat Janet Napolitano. But they do have a negative impact on state services and adding work to state employees. Any variation from the cap on new hires will be needed approval from Henderson, Chief of Staff Chad Campbell, and Budget Director Sarah Brown, according to the letter. The measures set out in Henderson's letter could get worse depending on how budget negotiations develop, but the bottom line is that whatever agencies propose to meet the guidelines are likely to become fact. Quote, "Please note that these cuts will be needed to be realistic, feasible, and agencies should expect that most items on your list will be reasonably proposed as a part of this year's budget negotiation," Henderson wrote. Strictly speaking, the governor cannot order other elected state officials to cut their spending, but Henderson is urging them to see if there are places where they can save. And there's another complicating factor. While the state has an $18 billion state budget, much of that is off limits to cuts. That starts with state aid to education. That is driven by a formula that includes both the number of students and inflation, and that totals more than $7 billion. Add to that the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, the state's Medicaid program. This, too, is formula-driven and runs to about $2.5 billion. And then there may not be much flexibility within the Department of Corrections with its $1.5 billion budget, which already has been ordered by a federal judge to spend more to provide adequate health care for inmates. Retaliation or criminal conspiracy? Attorneys for indicted Cochise County supervisors aim to toss case. Written by Howard Fisher and published in the Arizona Capital Times on April 20th, 2024. Attorneys for two Cochise County supervisors facing criminal charges lashed out Friday in a hearing at Attorney General Chris Mays for indicting them in the first place. Dennis Willinchick, who represents Tom Crosby, called the move, quote, vindictive and in retribution, because his client and Peggy Judd, both Republicans, said they had the right to get some questions answered before they certified the results of the 2022 election. He said the indictment was, quote, based on broad reading of the statute that was never written that way or intended that way. Quote, what we have here is a rogue prosecutor and a rogue prosecution, Willinchick said, who was seeking to read into the motives of the pair who voted to delay formal certification. Kurt Altman, who represents Judd, told Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Jeffrey Fish that the pair are facing criminal charges that could send them to prison for up to 2.5 years simply because they voted to table a motion to delay certification. That, he said, was their right. Quote, they've been indicted in this case on an absolute legislative function, he said. But Assistant Attorney General Todd Lawson said this involves more than the vote by the pair, with Democrat Ann English dissenting, to delay the certification on November 30, 2022. Quote, this is an overall conspiracy, a larger plan, he said, including an effort to force a hand count of all the ballots and even a lawsuit filed against Lisa Mara, who was the county's elections director. That all started in October, Lawson said, in the hearing to determine whether to throw out the case or send it back to the grand jury. He said efforts by defense attorneys to say this is just about the vote itself, which may or may not be protected by legislative immunity, quote, ignores the totality of the entire conspiracy. But regardless of the often overheated rhetoric, the question of whether the supervisors will have to go on trial next month could depend on a simple question. Do they, as elected officials, have the authority to examine and question the results, or do they just have to accept them without question? And how Fish answers that question could have statewide impact, determining for the future how much power county supervisors have to raise what they believe are legitimate issues that could affect the accuracy of the results. A few facts are clear. Arizona law requires that supervisors in each county do a formal canvass of votes within 20 days after the election. That deadline in 2022 was November 28th. That vote in Cochise County got postponed until November 30th because Crosby wanted to question both Katie Hobbs, who was the Secretary of State at the time, and election doubters about whether the machines that were used to tally votes had been properly certified. But the meeting notice that day included only the canvass and not the examination the Republicans wanted, so the items were put on the December 2nd agenda. Unwilling to wait any longer, however, Hobbs filed suit and got a judge to order the board to act, and it did so on December 1st, with Judd joining Democrat Ann English. Crosby did not show up. That led to an indictment last year on a charge of illegal interference with an election officer. That is based on what the state says was an attempt to prevent Hobbs from completing the statewide canvass, which had to be done by December 5th. A separate count charges the pair for conspiring to delay the formal vote. Friday's three-hour hearing featured arguments about not just what laws may or may not have been broken, but also whether the state grand jury had jurisdiction and whether that grand jury proceeding was conducted fairly. But what it may all come down to is whether county supervisors really have an authority to scrutinize the numbers they get from elections officials or whether, as Willinchick put it, they are merely a rubber stamp. Lawson contends that a canvass is strictly a ministerial function. In essence, that means the supervisors review the vote tallies and, unless there are missing votes from a precinct, declare the results official and forward them to the Secretary of State. That, he said, made the failure to perform the canvass within the time guidelines a crime. Willinchick said that makes no legal or practical sense. He said there's a reason the law requires a formal vote versus just having county election officials forward the results to the Secretary of State. And that, said Willinchick, is to ensure that the reported results are accurate. In this case, Crosby and Judd said questions had been raised about whether the machines used to tally the votes had been properly certified. Willinchick said that's why they delayed the certification to get answers. Quote, how could someone, particularly an elected official voting their conscience, who had judicial immunity for doing so, be charged with knowing that somehow their vote to continue to a date that was a few days away to get answers to questions that they legitimately had about the election and then canvass, how could that be, first of all, known to be a ministerial act as they claim, he asked. Quote, if that's the case, there's no point at all, Willinchick said, of the canvass. Why would the legislature even have a county do so if all the attorney general's position is that they really are just a rubber stamp and there's no point to them even talking about anything or considering anything? Lawson sniffed at the idea that there was some legitimate reason for the delay. He pointed out that Corey Lorick, who was the state elections director, already had answered questions from the board, both in person and through letters, and addressed any concerns in a very detailed manner. Quote, the delay here was so that Mr. Crosby could get a kangaroo court trial of election deniers on one side and Hobbs on the other to answer the concerns of these group of individuals who had already expressed those concerns repeatedly at previous meetings. But Lawson said there was no basis for that. Quote, they had no issue with the way the votes were counted. They had no issue with the numbers they had received from the county elections department, he said. The goal, Lawson said, was to create chaos within the election returns. At least part of what would have occurred had the county not gotten the results to Hobbs before December 5th. That would have forced her to certify the statewide election results, but without the 47,284 votes cast by Cochise County residents. And without those, Republican Tom Horn would have lost the race for schools chief to Democrat Kathy Hoffman, and Kirsten Engel, the Democrat candidate for the CD6 race, would have had more votes than Republican Juan Ciscomani. There's another angle to that question of whether a canvass is a legislative act. In general, lawmakers, and that includes supervisors, are immune from prosecution for votes that they take. They also cannot be questioned about their motives. Lawson, however, told Fish that even isn't absolute. Consider, he said, a case where an elected official had been bribed to vote a certain way. Quote, they could not turn around and say, I'm immune because it was a vote, he said. It produces an absurd result. And this, said Lawson, fits into the same category. Quote, this is a criminal conspiracy to obstruct the election so that the Secretary of State is unable to certify so that chaos will be created and no one will know what will happen, he said. Willinchick countered that, when all was said and done, the supervisors did not interfere with Hobbs' ability to certify the results on December 5th, but Lawson said that was only because the board had to be sued to get a court order to act. Fish must consider other issues of whether the process used to indict the pair was legal. For example, chose to invoke her Fifth Amendment rights to refuse to answer questions. But Altman pointed out that that she came after she was told by Lawson in front of the grand jurors, and that she had a constitutional right to refuse to answer any questions, quote, if a truthful answer to the question would tend to incriminate you. Quote, that's not entirely accurate, Altman told the judge. He said the Fifth Amendment permitted Judd to refuse to answer any questions, regardless of whether they might be incriminating. Quote, so that advisement left the grand jury with an impression that if she takes the Fifth Amendment, that means if she testified truthfully, she would have incriminated herself, Altman said, and that was compounded by Lawson never informing the jurors that they cannot draw any conclusions by Judd's refusal to answer. The judge gave no date by which he will rule on the issues. Former Speaker Jim Weers passes. An obituary published in the Arizona Capital Times on April 20th, 2024. A former Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives passed away Friday, April 19th, 2024, after a battle with congestive heart failure. Jim Weers died peacefully, surrounded in his final hours by his wife Gina, his four children, and his 12 grandchildren. Born in South Dakota, Jim moved to Phoenix, where he met and married his wife, Gina. They moved to Texas and finally back to Phoenix for good, starting several businesses along the way. He found his way into politics and was first elected to the Arizona House in 1994 and served in the legislature until 2013. He served two stints as Speaker from 1999 to 2001 and again from 2005 to 2009 with a term in the Senate in between. Jim never met a person he could not entertain for hours with stories of his youth or businesses or political experiences. He held court in the Speaker's office, sharing stories as he befriended members of the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats. Weers was fond of comparing the legislature to school. The Senate was the library. The House was the playground. Jim preferred the House. Jim still drove his 1972 VW Bug with a custom 1937 Ford hood and grill. He refused to get rid of it because it was the car he had when he began dating Gina. Outside the legislature, Jim was a dedicated family man and a regular attendee of the Church of Christ. He loved to entertain at large gatherings with the many small grandchildren in his family. He never gave up on his love of politics and was a dedicated Republican until the end. Weers is survived by his wife Gina, four kids, 12 grandchildren, his brother, Glendale Mayor Jerry Weers, his stepmother, Joanne Weers, and four sisters. You've been listening to the Arizona Capital Times, a production of Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. Once again, my name is John Coe. Thank you for listening.